It is only when you believe in this universal God that you could then say that rebellion to tyrants is in obedience to this God.
The Tikva Fund presents Jewish Ideas and the American Founders. Jewish Ideas and the American Founders is dedicated by Alan K. Schwartz in memory of his wife, Barbara R. Schwartz, and in tribute to all Jewish Americans, both strangers and neighbors, and is supported by the Zahava and Moshe L. Strauss Center for Torah and Western Thought at Yeshiva University. Rabbi Soloveitchik, as we enter into this second lecture dedicated to the seal and the idea of freedom that it evoked in America, maybe you could just bring us inside Philadelphia at the time as the seal was being debated.
People today refer to the 4th of July as the birthday of the United States. But the truth is that by the time the 4th of July rolled around, American independence was a done deal. Because, and I say this as a John Adams aficionado, the true break with Britain occurred 2 days earlier, on July 2nd, when the Lee Resolution was voted on, through which the Congress declared that they were absolving all fealty to the British Crown. That was the great vote, the one which needed to be unanimous. But it's on July 4th that something else happens, which is after voting on the Declaration, Congress passes a resolution that Franklin, Adams, and Jefferson should form a committee to design a seal for this new nation. This is new. This is the real new event of July 4th. And when you think about it, it's a very interesting question. What few people get to found a nation? So few people get to think about what is the symbol I'm going to choose for this new nation. And it happens to be that two of the three choose, at least for part of the seal, not just a biblical symbol, but a biblical symbol that is linked to the Jewish freedom story, the freedom story of the people of Israel, which is the story of the Exodus. And as Jews studying the impact of Jewish ideas on America, it behooves us to ask, if Franklin is choosing this scene and Jefferson is choosing this scene, what about these specific scenes speak to them? And what does one tell us that the other does not? What is the unique message of each biblical image that they are choosing?
Rabbi Soloveitchik, what are the couple of things you'd like viewers, both Jewish and non-Jewish, to keep in mind from this second lecture?
Well, first of all, for Jews, I want this lecture not just to teach them about America, but to teach them about Pesach, to teach them about Passover. Because my own view is that the Haggadah, the liturgy of the Seder, is actually a work of Jewish political thought. That it teaches us about the Jewish conception of freedom. And that this can be deduced from the liturgy and even the foods of the Seder itself. So I'm hoping that this lecture will really not only impact their understanding of American Jewish history and the story of American Judaism, but also of a practice central to almost any observant family. For both Jews and non-Jews, I'm seeking to highlight the centrality that the story of the Hebrew Bible and its political ideas had in the minds of the founders and in the population of America at the time of the Revolution. We begin with perhaps my favorite American Passover story. And this takes place in April of 1862. And it features a private in the Union Army by the name of Joseph Joel, who was serving in an Ohio regiment that found itself stationed in West Virginia. Passover rolls around. And Joel, along with some of his fellow Jews serving in this regiment, ask their commander for permission to organize a Seder to celebrate Pesach. And so he asked his commander, whose name was Rutherford B. Hayes, future president of the United States, and permission was received. And so he writes, and this is a lengthy description that he wrote up in a Jewish newspaper some years later. He describes what happened after that. He writes, "Our next business was to find some suitable person to proceed to Cincinnati, Ohio, to buy us matzahs. Our sutler," that's the guy who provides with food, "being a co-religionist," coincidence, "and going home to that city, readily undertook to send them. We were anxiously awaiting to receive our matzahs, and about the middle of the morning of Erev Pesach, a supply train arrived in camp, and to our delight, 7 barrels of matzahs. On opening them, we were surprised and pleased to find that our thoughtful sutler had enclosed 2 Haggadahs and prayer books. We were now able to keep the Seder nights if we could only obtain the other requisites for that occasion." So then they begin to forage for the rest of the ingredients for a proper Seder. "About the middle of the afternoon, the foragers arrived, having been quite successful. We obtained 2 kegs of cider," this is in lieu of wine, "a lamb, several chickens, and some eggs. Horseradish or parsley we could not obtain. But in lieu, we found a weed whose bitterness, I apprehend, exceeded anything our forefathers enjoyed." And so he then writes, "The necessaries for the charutzas," that's charosas, "we could not obtain. So we got a brick, which, rather hard to digest, reminded us by looking at it for what purpose it was intended." He describes the Seder commencing. "The ceremonies were passing off very nicely until we arrived at the part where the bitter herb was to be taken. We all had a large portion of the herb ready to eat at the moment I said the blessing. Each ate his portion when, horrors, what a scene ensued in our little congregation it is impossible for my pen to describe. The herb was very bitter and very fiery, like cayenne pepper, and excited our thirst to such a degree that we forgot the law authorizing us to drink only 4 cups. And the consequence was we drank up all the cider. Those that drank the more freely became excited." Excited means drunk. "And one thought he was Moses, another Aaron, and one had the audacity to call himself a Pharaoh. The consequence was a skirmish with nobody hurt. Only Moses, Aaron, and Pharaoh had to be carried to the camp." Then he goes on to say, "There in the wild woods of West Virginia, away from home and friends, we consecrated and offered up to the ever-loving God of Israel our prayers and sacrifice. I doubt whether the spirits of our forefathers, had they been looking down on us, standing there with our arms by our side, ready for an attack, faithful to our God and our cause, would have imagined themselves amongst mortals, enacting this commemoration of the scene that transpired in Egypt. Since then," he concludes, "a number of my comrades have fallen in battle in defending the flag. They volunteer to protect with their lives. I have myself received a number of wounds, all but mortal, but there is no occasion in my life that gives me more pleasure and satisfaction than when I remember the celebration of Passover of 1862. And Joseph Joel later wrote Rutherford B. Hayes, who was then governor of Ohio, to inform him that he had had a son whom he named Rutherford Hayes Joel. We consider that in my family as well. Rutherford Hayes Soloveitchik was a candidate for one of our children. Now, why is this such a moving story? It's moving, of course, first and foremost, because it testifies both to the dedication that these soldiers had to Judaism and the freedom with which they found to practice their faith. And it's a testament to the freedom and welcome that Jonas Phillips' life testified to, that Jews found in America. At the same time, there is another layer of meaningfulness here, because this is not only a story about soldiers serving in a war that takes some time to observe the Pesach Seder. As Joel himself notes, or at least implies, when he describes he and his compatriots as being faithful to our God and to our cause, we cannot help but note that Joel himself was observing the Seder while he is serving in a war that is very much about slavery and freedom. And observing the Pesach Seder at that moment lends a deeper dimension and melds in a certain way the uniquely Jewish religious ritual that has taken place and this moment in the American story. And it highlights that while the Pesach Seder and the story of Passover is first and foremost and always will be first and foremost a Jewish story that has a unique connection to the people of Israel, it is also a universal story that has changed the world and has had a particular impact on America. And it's that impact that I will examine today in our discussion of America's Passover, Jefferson, Franklin, and the Seal of the United States. It was on July 4th, 1776, immediately after approving the Declaration of Independence, that the Continental Congress advanced the following resolution: that Dr. Franklin, Mr. J. Adams, and Mr. Jefferson be a committee to bring in a device for a seal for the United States of America. And so they met over the next couple months to actually decide, now that they had engaged in this great revolution, what should be the symbol of their cause and of this new nation. Of the three founders, two put forward suggested seals that incorporated profoundly biblical images. Franklin, according to his own notes, suggested as the national seal a picture of, quote, Moses standing on the shore and extending his hand over the sea, thereby causing the same to overwhelm Pharaoh, who was sitting in an open chariot, a crown on his head and a sword in his hand. Rays from a pillar of fire in the clouds reaching to Moses express that he acts by command of the deity. Underneath the image, Franklin added, would appear the following motto: rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God. What's fascinating is that Franklin not only chooses the scene, but he chooses a motto which he believes captures the scene, but also allows one to engage in a transference from the original Passover story to America's independence story, thereby universalizing the story, saying that we are the new Israel. Israel's story is our story. And that motto is, rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God. And so on the one hand, Franklin is using a profoundly Jewish story, but he's universalizing it by saying, this story is not only a story, this story is something that teaches us about the rights of man and about the nature of humanity and of freedom that was communicated by God to the Jewish people a long time ago. And we are building. That's Franklin's scene. Jefferson, in contrast, according to John Adams' recollection, suggested a seal that bore a different image, also from the Hebrew Bible. Quote, the children of Israel in the wilderness, led by a cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. Now, what's striking is that while the Declaration's approval on the 4th of July is celebrated throughout the land to this day, the tale of the seal, which is a 4th of July story all its own, has been largely forgotten. Bruce Feiler, in his own book, America's Prophet, Moses and the American Story, writes that when he first discovered this tale of the seal, quote, this news stunned me. Why hadn't I heard about this before? The historian Michael Meyerson writes that he utilized Google Books to search every biography of Thomas Jefferson to see how many made mention of this story, and of the more than 200 Jefferson biographies that were published since 1950, only 12 made mention of his Great Seal proposal. Now, those who have written on the suggestions of this congressional committee tend to equate the proposals of Franklin and Jefferson because both are taken from the Bible. In fact, however, the messages behind these two images are quite different. With the biblical tale of the splitting of the sea, Franklin is selecting a scriptural story in which God himself miraculously intervenes into the natural order and redeems his people. Jefferson's symbol, in contrast, emphasizes the courage of the people of Israel to journey into the desert. It celebrates not the miracle performed by God, but rather that of the human spirit. Whereas Franklin chose to emphasize divine might made manifest against tyrants, Jefferson, in contrast, is arguing that the seal of this newly born country must celebrate rather freedom as a journey, as a process, emphasizing the willingness of a people to persevere in tough times and to remain true to the values of its founding. Even more fascinating is the fact that these two different themes from Exodus that were chosen for these two very different seals are embodied in the two distinct names for the Jewish festival of freedom. Both derive from the Bible. and which actually originally referred to two different days. The first, which is the name we usually give to the 7 or 8 day holiday the Jews celebrate, but which is originally appended to the 14th of Nisan, is Pesach. Pesach means, not as is usually translated, Passover, but rather it refers to God hovering over Israelite homes in Egypt, protecting them from the plague, shielding them from the plague. God is not skipping over Israelite houses. He does not need blood on the homes to tell him which houses to skip. He's already done 9 other plagues where he knew exactly how to differentiate between Israelite houses and non-Israelite houses. He does not need the blood on the door to teach him that. Rather, the blood on the door is a sacrificial ritual that turns each Israelite home into a temple. God hovers over, that's what poseach means, each home, and the plague, which you'll remember as that green thing from the Ten Commandments going around killing people, God is hovering over each home and shielding them from the plague. Or as I often say, Pesach should not be called Passover, it should be called hangover. That's actually a better and more accurate title for the holiday. But it's about God intervening into the natural order, wreaking vengeance on Egypt and saving the people of Israel. It's about what God does for us. Then there is another name for the days that follow, utilized throughout the Torah. To this day, it's what we call the 7 or 8 day holiday in our Siddur, and that's Chag HaMatzot, the festival of unleavened bread, making reference to the Israelites rushing out of Egypt into the wilderness. And as they rushed, they took ugot matzot ki lo chametz, ki lo yachlu litmameh v'gam tzedah lo asu lahem. The people took their dough before it was leavened, their kneading troughs being bound up in their clothes upon their shoulders, for they were thrust out of Egypt and could not tarry. And as they journeyed, eating unleavened bread, Exodus continues, v'Hashem holech lifnehem yomam b'amud anan, the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of cloud and by night in a pillar of fire. This, of course, is Jefferson's image. And it is the journey of a people into the frontier, emphasizing thereby less what God was doing for us, but what we were doing for God. And this is the verse that was read this past Shabbat. Ko amar Hashem zacharti lachesed nurayach ahavat klulotayach. As Jeremiah says, I remember the loyalty of your youth, how you were willing to follow me into the desert, into an unsown land. Lech teich acharai b'amidbar, b'eretz lo zeruah. Unfortunately, neither Franklin nor Jefferson's suggestion for the national seal of the United States were ultimately embraced by the Continental Congress, who instead, after tabling these images and after going through a various series of suggestions, gave us instead that creepy pyramid with the eye on it as the seal of the United States. Nevertheless, the unknown and uncelebrated story of Franklin and Jefferson's seal is enormously instructive, politically, philosophically, and theologically. Because these two 4th of July images from Exodus, Pesach, and the festival of Matzot, tell us something profound about the endeavor in which the founding fathers were engaged. This is not to make the case that Franklin and Jefferson were the two most devout of the founding fathers. No one familiar with American history could make that case. And indeed, we will discuss in a different lecture Jefferson's lack of devotion to the entirety of the biblical text. I mean, you're talking about a man who literally created a Bible with just the verses that he liked and made a Bible out of that. But these were great men, well aware of the perilous endeavor in which they were engaged and of the symbolism of the stories that they each selected as the national seal. As such, I propose to take these two suggested seals, these two images from Exodus, to reflect upon the distinct but complementary messages that they present us, and suggest in this lecture that taken together in tandem, they give us rightly understood not only a complete picture of the Passover story, but also a political theology of freedom through which we can reflect on the Hebraic heritage of the United States, why, therefore, that nation was such a wonderful home for Jews, as well as inspiring us to ponder the future of faith in American society. So we begin with Franklin's seal. The power of God, the manifestation of his might, and the motto, rebellion to tyrants, is obedience to God. What is being conveyed is that the political and theological are intertwined, and that we cannot discuss liberty without monotheism. And though we often miss this, this is actually at the heart of the Exodus story. We know the most famous scene, it's in the Ten Commandments, we have video footage of it. Moses comes before Pharaoh, thus says the Lord God of Israel, let my people go. Shalachat ami v'avduni. Sentence has inspired millions. But there was a line often left out of the stories we're telling, and Cecil B. DeMille, the great director himself, leaves it out of his depiction of the scene as well. And that is what happens after Pharaoh responds. Moses comes with Aaron, says, thus says the Lord God of Israel, let my people go. Pharaoh says,
I do not know your God, nor will I let Israel go.
And then Moses responds by saying something else, which is Elokei ha'ivrim, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. He seems to be adding something here, saying, Pharaoh, you don't understand. The God who demands our freedom is not only the God of Israel, he is the God of the Hebrews, hearkening back to the fact that he is the God of Avraham ha'ivri, Abraham the first Hebrew. What's he adding here? What difference does it make whether he's called the God of the Israelites or of the Hebrews? Isn't that the same thing? Isn't that synonymous? Seems like the term Hebrew and God of the Hebrews is adding something here. It's often wrongly assumed that the term Hebrew, Ivri, is an ethnic term. One of my own mentors, Rabbi Norman Lamb, tells a story about where he was at a conference in Europe. There was a secular Israeli who was speaking there, who was making the case that he doesn't see himself as a Jew. He just sees himself as a secular national citizen of his country. So he was looking at the other Jews who were there, and he says to a British Jew, he says, you are a British national. He points to Rabbi Lamb and says, you are an American national. He says, and I am a Hebrew national. So Rabbi Lamb said, sir, you know, where I come from, Hebrew national is a type of kosher baloney. And what you are saying may be baloney, but it certainly isn't kosher. What does the term Hebrew mean? It's actually not an ethnic term, or at least not only an ethnic term. It has a theological implication. It's especially noteworthy that Israelites are called Hebrews when they are in crisis and servitude in a foreign land. So, Yosef, Joseph in prison, says, Ki ganov gunavti me'eretz ha'ivrim, v'sham itanu nar ivri. The concept of ivri is invoked when Jews are interacting with non-Jews, when Israelites are interacting with non-Israelites. So, Yonah, who are you, Jonah? Ivri anochi, I am a Hebrew. Bet Hashem Elokei Hashemayim anochi yirei, Asher bara et hayam et habashan. And I fear the Lord God of heaven, who's created the sea and the dry land. So what's going on here? It was Rabbi Yoel ben Nun who has noted that in the ancient Near East, most people believed in territorial divinities, local gods who exercised tyrannical rule over a country's inhabitants, but were powerless beyond that country's borders. Now, there is a political correlation to this theology, because for such a system, the slave in a foreign land has no moral rights or recourse, because his God has no claim in the land of his oppressors. In the Bible, by contrast, the God of the Hebrews is a God whose power and authority is everywhere. And it is to this God that a hint to Moses' meaning may lie in the very term Hebrew, because it derives from the word la'avor, to cross over. Abraham is the first to be called Ivri, no doubt because he crossed over to the land of Canaan, all the way from Mesopotamia, coming over the river from one land to another. But there is a theological corollary to this that we take for granted, but was actually shocking for the ancient Near East, which is that Abraham crossed over because the God who addressed him in Mesopotamia told him to, assuring him that he would be with him all the way in a different land. Because this is a God who is not attached to one country, because he existed long before countries. A God who rules the universe because he created the universe. So that is what's happening when Moses comes before Pharaoh. Moses comes to Pharaoh and says, God of the Israelites wants you to let his people go. And Pharaoh says, I believe you. So what? So your God wants to go. I never heard of him, but big deal. Of course their people's God wants to let them go, but this is Egypt. Your God has no power here. And so then Moses proceeds to instruct him otherwise by saying, the God of the Hebrews has sent us. Meaning, a God whose writ is not contained by borders. The name Ivri thus connotes one who, believing in this God, asserts that no place on earth is devoid of his presence and his providence and his moral demands. And this allows us to understand the other appearance of the word Hebrew in the Exodus story. And this is history's first case of, to use Franklin's phrase, rebellion to tyrants in obedience to God. Pharaoh's order to what the Bible calls the Hebrew midwives, the Miyaldot HaIvriot, to murder every Israelite boy. To the ethos of that age, the notion of opposing this order in the name of a God of slaves was ludicrous. But we are informed the Hebrew midwives feared God, and they did not do what Paro, king of Egypt, ordered them to do. Recognizing the moral claims of the God of the Hebrews as trumping even the king of Egypt in Egypt, a king who was himself worshipped as a god. We study this story, but we sometimes do not recognize the theological and moral revolution that is taking place here. It is in the universalistic aspect of monotheism on which the very claim to rights and human dignity lies. And it is on this premise that it is that the moral claims of Exodus are born. And that is why, of course, the Haggadah, the DNA of the Haggadah, is a constant intertwining of the political and the theological. On the one hand, we tell the story of, at the Seder, of the Exodus, Avadim Hayinu Lefaro B'Mitzrayim, we were slaves and God took us out. But we also talk about the birth of monotheism. Mitchila Ovdei Avodah Zarahu Avotenu, V'Yachshav Kervano HaMakom LaAvodato. We were originally idol worshippers, and in the age of Abraham, God brought us close to his service. That may be true, but why are we telling that story on Passover? What does that have to do with Passover? The answer is that it's everything to do with Passover. Because shorn of this universalistic, non-pagan, non-relativistic claim, if we believe only in gods whose demands are restricted to one specific country or different or constrained within borders, then the moral claim made by Exodus cannot be made. It is only when you believe in this universal God that you could then say that rebellion to tyrants is in obedience to this God. It's with this in mind that we can bring the story of the Exodus into conversation with one of the most famous and influential modern meditations on liberty. In 1958, Isaiah Berlin delivered what was called by Michael Ignatieff, his biographer, the most influential lecture he ever delivered. And in this lecture, Berlin distinguished between negative liberty and positive liberty. Negative liberty means freedom from liberty and avoidance of persecution. Within this perspective, the ability to do what we please is an objective virtue. But then there is the other approach of positive freedom, which means not freedom from, but freedom to. Freedom to realize a greater goal, a larger good. Positive freedom proclaims that liberty is not an end in itself, but is important because life has purpose, because there is a grand destiny for which we must be free. In this lecture, Berlin rejects positive liberty as a notion by which the despots of the 20th century could use to justify brutality in the name of historical destiny. Negative liberty, Berlin argues, was safer and allowed for a non-judgmental pluralism, as it were, to flourish. He concluded his famous essay by quoting Joseph Schumpeter, quote, to realize the relative validity of one's convictions and yet stand for them unflinchingly is what distinguishes a civilized man from a barbarian, end quote. Problem, of course, is that while authoritarianism or tyranny is certainly a major problem, relativism is not the solution. For, after all, and not that Berlin would put it this way, but if we only recognize the relative validity of our claims, why stand up for the inviolability of human beings if that is only relatively valid? Either it is true and worth fighting and even dying for, or it is relatively true and therefore not true in a society such as the Soviet Union, which does not recognize it. Thus the famous Russian joke in which Gorbachev is asked to summarize the state of the Soviet economy in one word, and Gorbachev says, good. Gorbachev is then asked to describe the state of the Soviet economy in two words. Not good, he says. Okay? The lesson of the moral claims of the Hebrew God is that the very source of liberty is not to disregard all notions of positive freedom, but rather to begin one's story that one tells about freedom by understanding the universality of moral rules. So the story of the Exodus begins actually not with Moses. It begins with the first act of rebellion to tyrants and obedience to God ever. And that is by two Hebrew midwives whose names we know, Shifra and Puah, but then disappear from the story. Perhaps are identified with other people in the story, but disappear from the story. They're not central figures, but the story begins with them. Because this is to teach us how freedom begins. It begins with universal moral claims, which are founded on the universality of the biblical God. Or to put it slightly differently, it teaches us what Norman Podhoretz in a critique of Berlin's lecture pointed out, that, quote, relativism, though it can be animated by a spirit of tolerance for and generosity toward other points of view, is nonetheless vulnerable to a disease of its own, namely the spinelessness that can develop from the rejection of any absolutes and the correlative failure to develop rock-bottom convictions, end quote. So the point then is that the appropriate way to prevent tyranny is not to emphasize only negative liberty, only the freedom to do what one wants, but rather to emphasize the universal code that lies at the heart of the political story about liberty that the Hebrew Bible tells. And this is an essential aspect of the political Hebraism of the Anglo-American world that so profoundly impacted the United States. One of the most important academic works of the last decade, Harvard professor Eric Nelson's book, The Hebrew Republic, points out that even as it's assumed that the achievements of modernity, such as democracy and religious freedom, came about through progressive secularization, the reverse, Eric argues, is actually the case. While the Renaissance reflected the pagan inheritance of antiquity and generated an approach to politics that was secular in character, Eric notes, it was following the Reformation that Christians began to regard the Hebrew Bible as a political constitution designed by God himself for the children of Israel. We'll discuss Eric's thesis and how it connects to Thomas Paine's book tomorrow morning. But the point of this is, for now, is that Franklin's suggested seal reminds us how political Hebraism took root in the English-speaking world and very much affected the American mind. And therefore, the rabbinic exhortation that b'chol dor v'dor omdim, that b'chol dor v'dor chayv adam lirot et atzmo kilu yatza mimitzrayim, that in every generation a person must see himself as if he actually left Egypt, an exhortation that perhaps Private Joel and his comrades at the Sewell Mountain Seder took just a little bit too literally, nevertheless, is not only a religious idea, it has political and moral implications as well. So Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, in his commentary on the Haggadah, writes as follows. There have been four revolutions in modern times, the British and the American and the French and the Russian. In Britain and America, the source of inspiration was the Hebrew Bible. In France and Russia, it was the great alternative to the Bible, namely philosophy, Marx, and Rousseau. The contrast between them, he writes, is vivid. Britain and America succeeded in creating a free society, not without civil war, but at least without tyranny and terror. The French and Russian revolutions began with a dream of utopia and ended with a nightmare of bloodshed and the suppression of human rights. Why did Britain and America succeed where France and Russia failed? The explanation is surely complex, but much, perhaps all, turns on how a society answers the question, who is the ultimate sovereign, God or man? The British and Americans gave the first answer, the French and Russian revolutionaries the second. For the British and American architects of liberty, God was the supreme power. All authority was therefore subject to the transcendental demands of the moral law. For the French and Russian ideologists, ultimate value lay in the state. When human beings arrogate supreme power to themselves, politics loses its sole secure defense of freedom. Societies that exile God lead to the eclipse of man. So the story of Judaism's notion of liberty begins with the universal claims of the moral law. It is with this, in the story of the Exodus, that we are introduced to the God of the Hebrews, the midwives who feared the commands of the God of the Hebrews, Moses who obeyed the and conveyed the demands of the God of the Hebrews, and the Pharaoh who did not. And of the God whose power and authority and justice is everywhere. So what follows is God not merely wreaking vengeance on the Egyptians, but, as Rabbi Sacks points out, God taking on every member of the divine pantheon of Egypt and turning it against Egypt itself. The Nile God turns to blood. Heket was a frog god, which was the fertility and midwife god, and so on and so forth. The penultimate plague was darkness, which is surprising because you'd expect the plagues, or Sacks points this out, to get progressively worse. Which would you rather have, 3 days of darkness or boils? Which would you rather have, 3 days of darkness or lice? Which would you rather have, 3 days of darkness or pretty much any other plague? But what's happening here is not merely punishment. The head god of the Egyptian pantheon is, of course, Ra, the sun god. God, before the plague of the firstborn, takes out the sun itself. This is a union of politics and theology. The very Exodus story is all about that. Because only with obedience to God can the philosophy of the rebellion to tyrants truly take place. And so this is what one name for the Festival of Freedom, Pesach, which is all about God's involvement in Egypt and in the story of Israel and the plagues that follow, that's what that name connotes. The name is not merely a reference to one miracle. It is a reference to God's authority and the universal monotheistic morality on which the biblical conception of freedom is founded. And only after, that's why you start in the original biblical calendar, you have a holiday called Pesach on the 14th of Nisan, marking this moment. And then you have a festival of freedom, Chag HaMatzot, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, that follows, because only after the enunciation of this universal moral and religious principle can the story of positive freedom, the story of Israel's journey into the desert, the story embodied by Jefferson's seal, only then, in Chag HaMatzot, does that festival truly begin. Because, of course, there is no more powerful image of positive freedom than the other Exodus image put forward by the July 4th Founding Fathers National Seal Commission. Jefferson's scene is all the more interesting because Franklin's selection seems so much more natural. Franklin's scene is an Exodus scene. It is freedom. Whereas Jefferson chooses not the freedom itself, but what happens right after that. It's Israel entering the wilderness. What the Bible describes as V'Hashem holeich lifnehem b'amud anan l'anchotam aderach v'layla b'amud esh la'ir lahem melechet yomam v'layla. God going before them in the desert with a pillar of fire at night and a cloud during the day. So Jefferson, instead of choosing the freedom itself, the vanquishing of Pharaoh, the breaking of the bonds of slavery, he chooses the journey into the wilderness, the journey into the desert, to embody the journey on which America was setting out. That's a fascinating selection. It's especially interesting because, as we will see, Jefferson was really one of the more secular of the founders and probably one of the least positive in general about the Hebrew Bible. Ironic, of course, because part of our story is about a Jewish family that saved his home and helped preserve his legacy. But Jefferson was not a philo-Semite. Nevertheless, he's the one who chooses this seal. It's discussed in very few biographies of Jefferson, but he's the one who chooses. That's significant. And it shows that even for someone like Jefferson, who was as close to a French revolutionary as you would get in America, still chose this biblical scene. At the moment of American freedom, Jefferson chose not an image of triumph, but of perseverance, which seems to indicate that freedom is not one moment. It is a journey. The seal and its what it represents, reflects, in the felicitous phrase of Yuval Levin, the long road to liberty, meaning that redemption from physical shackles is only the beginning. It is a freedom toward something great. And because in Judaism the theological is linked to that which is the most important element in our lives, which for Jews, of course, is food, it is worth considering the name of the festival to which our freedom is linked. Who names their festival after food? Our great freedom holiday is not called the Festival of Freedom. It is called the Festival of Matzah. What kind of a name is that? And we have to pause to ponder how odd and actually strange it is. Because if matzah is what the Bible claims it is, which is poor man's bread or bread of affliction, surely it makes more sense that we should celebrate our freedom by eating the opposite of matzah, which is, of course, zamik challah, right? The challah that metaphysically never goes bad and lasts forever and can never be destroyed. Which looks like a better bread? Which deserves more to be affiliated with freedom? It is odd that the Bible says we're going to take this political holiday and we're going to call it the Festival of Unleavened Bread. What's up with that? So they rushed out. And so on the way, they had to eat unleavened bread. So what? The point is profound, and it's making a political point. The culinary is philosophical in Judaism. Always. It is always philosophical. Here, too, Rav Yoel ben Nun is instructive. He points out that matzah is bread at the beginning of the process of its production. Usually, in at least in Egyptian society, you would knead water into dough, then you would allow it to rise, you would actually add starter that would allow it to rise if you've baked, and only after it has risen would you bake it. Matzah is bread that has been halted at the beginning of its production. Flour baked immediately after water has been added to it, whereas something like challah is dough that has been allowed to rise and achieve its ultimate end. Matzah, says Rabbi Ben Nun, symbolizes the idea that the exodus from Egypt is only the beginning of the redemption process. Matzah serves as a reminder that the exodus is just the beginning of a journey, that there is a long, hard road through the desert and through the story of our people, that the beginning of the freedom was the exodus from Egypt, but that there was a goal. The first goal, of course, being Sinai. The goal after that being the Promised Land. That this was only the beginning, not an end in itself. This brings to mind the what I call the greatest Dvar Torah, the greatest Torah discourse ever given by a Christian at a Passover Seder. And this is a story of a different Pesach Seder in the American Army. Lieutenant General Mark W. Clark, commander of the United States Fifth Army, addressed Jewish soldiers attending a Seder in Naples, Italy in April 1944. Here is what he said. Tonight, he says, you are eating unleavened bread just as your forebears ate unleavened bread. Because the Exodus came so quickly, the dough had no time to rise. There was, said General Clark, there was a time of unleavened bread in this war. The time when it looked as though we might not have time to rise. Time to raise an army and equip it. Time to stop the onrush of a Germany that had already risen. But the bread has begun to rise. It started at Alamein. It was rising higher when the Fifth Army invaded Italy. It is reaching the top of the pan, and soon the time will come when it will spread out and victory will be ours. Ladies and gentlemen, how unbelievable Dvar Torah is that? From a Christian general leading the Fifth Army of the United States. So the bread of freedom is the bread that has only just begun to rise. Because the matzah reminds us that freedom is a beginning, not an end. Or at least freedom from physical servitude is a beginning, not an end. That it was the start of the Jewish journey. But that journey was not yet complete. The liberation from physical fetters is only the beginning. There is a tradition among some Sephardic Jews and Italian Jews who, that at their Seder, they put three pieces of matzah tied up in a napkin like a little sack. And the sack is passed to different people. And I'm quoting here from somewhere where I discovered this. And first the sack would be held on the person's right shoulder and the leader would ask her or him, where are you from? And the person with the shoulder sack would reply, I am from Egypt. The leader then asked the same person, where are you going? And the person with the sack would shift it to his left shoulder and say, I am going to Jerusalem. Will you come with me? The sack is then passed to the next person at that table who says, yes. And the tradition beautifully embodies freedom as not an end in itself, but something positive, as a journey towards something. And so Jefferson may not have revered every verse in the Bible, but he chose his image wisely, for it reflects the fact that he understood that freedom was only the beginning. And indeed, we know the main goal of for which the Exodus was took place in the first place. As God himself said to Moses from the burning bush, Zelacha ha'ot ki anochi shalachticha peltaita ta'ami mitzrayim ta'avduna ta'lukim ala harazeh. This shall be the sign that I have sent you. When you take the people out of Egypt, you shall serve the Lord on this mountain. And this means, strikingly, that Sinai, the giving of the law, is the purpose of the Exodus, or that the giving of the law is part of the long road to liberty. And this may seem initially odd, because being bound by the law should seem inimical to freedom. But it's actually part and parcel of it. Indeed, perhaps the most audacious thing we say in the Seder, which we often miss, is that we're supposed to tell our children, pointing to the mitzvot, the commandments we do at the Seder, Ba'avur zeh asa Hashem li betzeiti mimitzrayim. Pointing to the matzah, we say, because of this, God took us out of Mitzrayim, out of Egypt. Which turns the whole thing on its head. Instead of saying we are eating matzah to remember that we got out of Egypt, we are saying God took us out of Egypt so that we can do this. God took us out of Egypt so that we could obey these laws, so that we could keep these commandments, so that we could fulfill these rituals. This is striking, and it seems to indicate that for Jews, law is not inimical to freedom, but is actually part of the road to liberty. So let's digress for a moment to another interesting union of food, freedom, and Jewish ritual to analyze why this is so. And this digression is a union of food and Jewish ritual, not in the Bible, but in my own life. And that is a time a couple years ago where I took New York Times columnist David Brooks to Pomegranate Kosher Supermarket, the most magical place on earth, in a Flatbush in Brooklyn. And he wrote a story. He wrote a story about it. By the way, has Pomegranate given me any discounts for all the publicity I provided them? No, they have not. And I'm not over it. But here's what David wrote. And I showed him all the, you know, amazing products, etc. And he writes, "The thing about the store is not found in one section, but is pervasive throughout. That's the specialty products designed around this or that aspect of Jewish law. There are dairy-free cheese puffs. These are cheese curls. In case you want to have some cheese puffs with a meat dish." I spent a lot of time discussing how all of science and technology has led to this moment of the creation of Parv cheese curls. Because they really, it's a magical thing. There are pre-cut disposable tablecloths, so you don't have to use scissors on the Sabbath. There are specially designed sponges, which don't retain water, so you don't have to do the work of squeezing out water on Shabbat. Pomegranate, writes David, looks like in any island of upscale consumerism, but deep down it is based on a countercultural understanding of how life should work. Those of us in secular America live in a culture that takes the supremacy of individual autonomy as a given. You choose your own path. You live in the city or the suburbs, be a Wiccan or a biker. For the people who shop at Pomegranate, the collective covenant with God is the primary reality, and obedience to the laws is the primary obligation. They go shopping like the rest of us, but their shopping is minutely governed by an external moral order. So then later, when we were talking about this, you know, we were discussing how all these rules work and whether they constrict one's life or not. And so in response, I cited to David an insight by the Belgian-Dominican commentator on Aquinas, Servais Pinckaers, as explicated by George Weigel, to whom I'm indebted. This is a piece in First Things, which is, as it were, a response as well to Berlin's lecture on freedom. And my remarks in this lecture are indebted to Weigel because he really got me thinking about the role that Berlin's positive liberty and negative liberty plays in this discussion. So here are Weigel's words, which I quoted and which ultimately made its way into David's column. According to one of his most eminent contemporary interpreters, the Belgian-Dominican Servais Pinckaers, Aquinas' subtle and complex thinking about freedom is best captured in the phrase, freedom for excellence. Freedom is the means by which, exercising both our reason and our will, we act on the natural longing for truth, for goodness, and for happiness that is built into us as human beings. Thus, as Pinckaers notes, virtue and the virtues are crucial elements of freedom rightly understood, and the journey of a life lived in freedom is a journey of growth in virtue, growth in the ability to choose wisely and well the things that truly make for our happiness and for the common good. It's a bit, Pinckaers says, like learning to play a musical instrument. Anyone can bang away on a piano, but that is to make noise, not music, and it's a barbaric, not humanistic expression of freedom. At first, learning to play the piano is a matter of some drudgery, as we master exercises that seem like a constraint, a burden. But as our mastery grows, we discover a new, richer dimension of freedom. We can play the music we like. We can even create new music on our own. Freedom, in other words, writes Weigel, it's a matter of gradually acquiring the capacity to choose the good and to do what we choose with perfection. Which means, he says, that law is thus intertwined with freedom. Law can educate us in freedom. Law is not a work of heteronomous external imposition, but a work of wisdom. And good law facilitates our achievement of the human goods that we instinctively seek because of who we are and what we are meant to be as human beings. This is the import of Jefferson's freedom. The journey of Egypt, the journey from Egypt, the journey guided by God, the journey that is not only freedom from, but freedom towards. And this is captured by how traditional Jews celebrate freedom, by gathering as a family and performing the yearly rituals in which we have been commanded. Because these institutions, the family and the obligations and responsibilities involved in the law, these are the institutions that may seem to compromise our freedom in a profound way. There is no one less free than the parent of a child or the obeyer of the law, and yet there is no one freer, because it is these obligations and responsibilities involved in the law that show a deeper dimension of freedom that are part and parcel of the long road to true liberty. So these then are the two images from Exodus that our founders recommend to us. There is Franklin's, the Hebrew God, whose power, authority, and morality is everywhere. And then there is Jefferson's journey, the image of positive freedom. And when we ask the question, which was asked to me after my earlier lecture, if the Jews and if Jews like Jonas Phillips found such a unique home in America, and if America was the first country that was actually open to a Jew bringing his faith into the public square, why was America uniquely this place? And the answer we are now able to begin to see starts with the profound role that religion, and particularly the Israelite story of the Exodus, played in the American self-understanding. In France, no one would have suggested that the seal of France be Moses at the sea, rebellion to tyrants as obedience to God. Religion and freedom functioned in two entirely different ways in Europe and in the United States. And when we look through early American rhetoric, we find the founders returning to both of these images. As we'll see in a later lecture, George Washington recognizes the miracles that God did for Israel, just as Franklin notes it in his seal. Washington, in his letter to the Jews of America, makes note of these miracles and compares the revolution to the miracles that occurred to Israel in Egypt. And then Jefferson, in his second inaugural, made reference to his proposed seal, the journey through the desert, in describing the journey that is the American experiment. Because he says, quote, "I shall need, too, the favor of that being in whose hands we are, who led our forefathers as Israel of old from their native land and planted them in a country flowing with all the necessaries and comforts of life, who has covered our infancy with his providence and our riper years with his wisdom and power, and to whose goodness I ask you to join with me in supplication, that he will so enlighten the minds of your servants, guide their counsels, and prosper their measures, that whatsoever they do shall result in your good and shall secure to you the peace, friendship, and approbation of all nations."
You see both of these seals as accurately capturing something that refers to, you know, the common understanding or common imagination of the American mind.
Oh, yes. The Bible itself was read devoutly by Americans everywhere. That's why, as we'll see, Thomas Paine, who didn't believe in any of it, utilizes the Bible and makes the Hebrew Bible the centerpiece of the argument that he's going to make in Common Sense. And the regiment that had an extraordinary impact on the American Revolution but didn't fight at all was the Ministers of America, who were not actually a regiment but were called the Black-Robed Regiment, because of the way they utilized biblical stories to make a political case for the revolution. It's a bit ironic that nowadays, and this is now being debated, but it's considered an endangerment of the tax-exempt status of a house of worship when politics is discussed from the pulpit. But of course, politics was discussed a great deal from the pulpit during the American Revolution. And because the Hebrew Bible is a much more political book than Christian scripture, you're just going to inevitably draw on the stories of the Hebrew Bible. So the story of Passover is thus intertwined with the American founding. And as the story of the Union soldier, Private Joseph Joel, indicates, its imagery and eternal lessons remained intertwined with the American story, playing a role not only in the Revolution, but in abolition, and in the civil rights movement. Indeed, to find an age when the Exodus and the American idea were intertwined, we need only go back to the generation of my parents' childhood, not that long ago, in 1955, Orthodox Jews that I knew on the West Side, who didn't go to movies that often, went to the movie theater that to this day is still right near my house. And they went to see Cecil B. DeMille's The Ten Commandments. They did not go because they needed to know the story. They knew what would happen. They did not need the spoiler alerts. They had already read the original book version. Nevertheless, they went to the theater in the knowledge that there was at least some connection between their own faith and the culture of their society. And indeed, this was reinforced by the unusual intro at the beginning of the film, because in the old day movie theaters, the curtain would rise over the screen. And before the movie actually started, Cecil B. DeMille appeared on the screen, and he said the following.
This may seem an unusual procedure, speaking to you before the picture begins. The theme of this picture is whether men are to be ruled by God's law or whether they are to be ruled by the whims of a dictator like Ramesses. Are men the property of the state or are they free souls under God? This same battle continues throughout the world today.
That's the beginning of the film, which connects the Exodus story to what America faced at that moment in 1955. And DeMille, of course, makes a very slight emendation to the script of the Bible when at the end he has Charlton Heston as Moses say, "Go proclaim liberty throughout all the lands unto all the inhabitants thereof," saying not throughout the land, ukratem dor b'chol ha'aretz, but throughout all the lands, thereby extending the story that he had just shown to all the lands that follows. And of course, this film became the most successful film in American history. Today, of course, the link between America's Hebraic heritage and America's contemporary popular culture have been entirely severed. So the secularization of the Moses story reflects a belief common to many progressives, that society grows more tolerant as it grows more secular, and that the Bible itself is the great source of intolerance in this world. And there's only one problem with this picture, and that is that, as if we have discussed, it's not true. Cecil B. DeMille's message that the Moses story reminds us that our rights derive from God rather than man was not merely anti-communist propaganda. It was profoundly American. 60 years ago, this Hebraic metaphysic was taken for granted by the culture. Now it is actively derided by the culture. And what is dominant is a relativism that bears a strong resemblance to the paganism against which biblical monotheism rebelled. And so the stakes are high for our society when we address the question as to whether it can survive when it has become severed from this story that was so central to the American founding. It is the Exodus that inspired America, the civil rights movement, the abolitionists, and many others. The religious message behind the story was inspiring, not destructive, and its impact was once celebrated in a culture that very religious Jews could enjoy in a movie theater on Manhattan's Upper West Side. I, of course, who live right near that movie theater, cannot take my kids to the theater to cinematically experience a biblical, there may be movies we may go see, maybe, but I cannot take them to the theater to cinematically experience a biblical idea that is an American idea. And usually I can't take them to the movie theater at all, because what plays there is all too often hostile to virtues that I believe are critical to my children's future as a Jew and as an American. So as Rabbi Sacks notes, reading the Bible, writing about the Exodus, Rabbi Sacks notes, reading the Bible, you would think Moses on the eve of the Exodus would speak to the Israelites about politics, policy, nationalism. But instead he speaks about children. Which means, as the rabbis interpret it, you must tell your children on this day, God took us out for this, that we may obey this, that we may do this. Moses, writes Rabbi Sacks, fixed his vision not on the immediate but on the distant future, and not on adults but children. In so doing, he was making a fundamental point. It may be hard to escape from tyranny, but it is harder to build and sustain a free society. End quote. Or to put it slightly differently, the Exodus Franklin's seal is only the beginning. It is Jefferson's seal, the long road to liberty, in which freedom can truly take root. We live in an age when the lessons of Exodus have been lost by too many, and when the message behind both Franklin and Jefferson's seal have faded from public consciousness. And the consequences for such forgetting can be dire. First, we have forgotten the lesson of Franklin's seal, of what the very meaning of the word Hebrew represents, and that the surest defense of freedom lies in the Abrahamic conception of a God whose power is everywhere, whose moral laws are not limited to one territory and another. The words of the Catholic theologian Michael Novak, who just passed away, speak to us profoundly. He said as follows: during the last 100 years, the question for those who loved liberty was whether, relying on the virtues of our people, we could survive powerful assaults from without. During the next 100 years, the question for those who love liberty is whether we can survive the most insidious and duplicitous attacks from within, from those who undermine the virtues of our people. There is no such thing as truth, they teach even the little ones. Truth is bondage. Believe what seems right to you. There are as many truths as there are individuals. Follow your feelings. Do as you please. Get in touch with yourself. Do what feels comfortable. Those who speak in this way, writes Novak, prepare the jails of the 21st century. They do the work of tyrants. End quote. Meanwhile, our culture has also lost the message of Jefferson's liberty, of positive freedom, of what Yuval Levin calls the long road to liberty. And as Yuval notes, complicit in the loss of this concept is not only the political left, but also increasingly the right, who promote increasingly today a very individualistic conception of freedom. As a result, as a consequence, he notes, while the left and the right have profound policy disagreements, both seem to believe that advancing human progress is a matter of shaping society in a certain way, rather than of the shaping of the human soul in a certain way. They take the human person largely for granted. But unfortunately, the left and right alike seem confused about what liberty and progress really mean and require. Meaning, or to put it in my words, the left embraces in policy moral libertinism, and the right is focused on economic libertarianism. But the long road to liberty, of the shaping of the human soul that is the true essence of liberty, is the focus of very few. In our time, he says, a commitment, says Levin, a commitment to the long way of freedom requires us to defend against a corrosive approach, which is championed by some progressives but too often enabled by conservatives. It encourages precisely Philistinism, a form of freedom that is but license for the morally unfree, and actively disparages every form of nobility, refinement, dignity, order, and transcendence. If we do not reclaim this conception of the long road to liberty, the moral health of our society cannot be sustained. And the point of Jefferson's seal is that without the long road to liberty, liberty itself cannot be sustained. It's often unknown that Cecil B. DeMille's 1955 film, The Ten Commandments, was itself a remake, as in 1923, he first made a silent film version of the Moses story. To serve as extras to play the Israelites in this silent film, DeMille hired several hundred Orthodox Jews, immigrants just off the boat from Eastern Europe. Unlike the later Ten Commandments, which was filmed in Egypt or in the Sinai, he filmed this in the desert in California and constructed an enormous set with the Sphinx and the Gates of Pharaoh, which has now been buried in the sand of the California desert. Here I'm quoting an article that describes this, but selecting from the article. A reporter described the filming of the Exodus scene, where a set of the gates of Egypt was set up in the California desert on the shores of the Pacific. The immigrants were not trained actors, but they did not need to act. As one article recounts, these Jews streamed out of the great gates with tears running down their cheeks, and then without prompting or rehearsal, they began singing in Hebrew the old chants of their race, which have been sung in synagogues for thousands of years. The article continues. An elderly woman, overcome with emotion, fell to her knees and shook a fist at the gates of Pharaoh, weeping and casting sand on her head. For the scene depicting the parting of the sea, actor Theodore Roberts, as Moses stood on a rock at the Pacific shoreline, surrounded by the children of Israel. As sunset approached, clouds blocked out the light, threatening to ruin the shot. Just then the clouds cleared. The nearly level rays of the sun made a halo around the figure of the prophet and gave a startling radiance to his face. A gasp went through the crowd, one spectator recalled. The faces of men and women reflected this light. Tears trembled on wrinkled cheeks. Sobs came from husky throats. For many, the world had moved back 3,000 years ago, and they stood once more on the shores of the Red Sea, viewing once more the good omen of their deliverance. According to the syndicated Hollywood columnist Jack Jungemeyer, the Jews chanted, "Father of mercy and hero Israel." He heard one of the older Jews say to a crew member, "We know this script. Our fathers studied it long before there were movies. This is the tale of our beginnings. It is deep in our hearts." And the writer of this article describing it concludes, "Most of them, immigrants from Eastern Europe, didn't speak English. Yet for them, the silent Ten Commandments was more than a movie. Playing the roles of their ancestors in the Exodus was emotional for them and the others on the set. And during those moments, the American dream and their heritage converged." It is a very moving story, but it is, of course, not the first time that the American dream and the story of the Exodus converged in America. That, as we now know, took place in the commission that was called together on July 4th, 1776. We're seeking a seal for the representation of their nation. Both Franklin and Jefferson, each in their own way, selected the seal. They too knew that script. And that script, like for those Orthodox Jews standing in the California desert, that script was written on their hearts. The connection between that biblical script and the American story was once profound, as recently as several decades ago. That link, at least in our popular culture, has largely been severed. But it's rediscovering that script and the political and religious messages contained therein that just might one day help save our civilization. Thank you.
So Franklin's suggestion seems to be looking back at the immediate action at July 2nd as his immediate inspiration. The rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God seems to refer directly to the break that America has just made with Great Britain. Whereas Jefferson's is a more prospective freedom, looking at the path that American freedom is about to embark. Do you see these two different understandings of freedom, both in here and the American experiment?
The suggestion I make in my lecture is that these symbols are very different, but they are complementary. And they're different in the following ways. First, Franklin is describing an event in which God himself enters the political fray and miraculously saves his people. And there were people who did see miracles in the American Revolution. A famous letter, I believe, to Jefferson. Someone wrote, "Is there not an angel in the whirlwind that directs this storm?" Jefferson is communicating a different message, not about what God is willing to do for us, but what we are willing to do. And this is also a Jewish idea. The first week of the 3 weeks, 3 weeks of mourning before Tisha B'Av, Jews read the words of Jeremiah. Zacharti lach chesed nurayach avat klulatayach lechtech acharai b'midbar be'eretz lo zuruah. That God says, it's not just that I freed you from Egypt, but I remember your chesed, and chesed is an often mistranslated word. Chesed means loyalty. That you were willing to follow me into the wilderness. So Jefferson is choosing to celebrate not this extraordinary break merely, and not the divine miraculous and the divinely brought about or miraculous or providential nature of this break. Jefferson is emphasizing this is going to be a long, hard slog. And we're going to celebrate the human courage necessary to achieve it. And of course, those two do not contradict each other. They're complementary. So on the one hand, Washington, in a letter to the Jews of Savannah, which we'll discuss in another lecture, says that the God of the Jews who did miracles for you, as Jews say, Misha asa nisim la'avoteinu, his actions were clear in the miracles that he did for us during the revolution. He doesn't say it that way, but he almost says that. Whereas other famed writings of the revolution focus on the courage of human beings. These are the times that try men's souls. It's the opening of one of Thomas Paine's essays or works, which is all about the courage to battle through Valley Forge and the difficulty that was faced by the revolution. So they're both themes that complement each other, that divine miracle and human courage. Then, also when we think about it, these two seals embody two different ideas about freedom, but that also complement each other. Franklin is highlighting the radical notion that is born in the Exodus, which is that if slaves have rights, if slaves have recourse, it's because there's actually a God who is everywhere, who created all, who endowed us in his image, and therefore gave us rights and endowed us with inviolability. Which, of course, in the ancient Near East was, nobody thought that way.
That human equality is rooted in our being created image and likeness of God.
And that in obedience to that God, you can rebel against a king who is worshipped as a God. We have rights not because the state gives us rights. We have rights because God gives us rights. And God can give us rights because he's everywhere and because he created us. And over those rights, the state is powerless. And that's a conception that's, of course, very different from the way most of mankind has thought for many, many centuries. But it's also different from the way that some of the West will be thinking in the revolutions that follow, in the French Revolution or the Russian Revolution, where it's the state that is the source of human rights, not God. And so the scene itself with the accompanying model, rebellion to tyrants, obedience to God, is utilizing a biblical story to show and to highlight the revolution in ideas that it brought about and how that revolution is firmly connected to the American Revolution. Jefferson, at least Jefferson's seal as I interpret it, is saying that, not that he disagrees with any of that, because Jefferson actually liked Franklin's suggestion very much, but Jefferson is saying the initial moment of freedom is just the beginning. Because, of course, the Exodus is inseparable from what followed, the journey first to Sinai and then to the Promised Land. Which means that the freedom that's born in the Exodus is not just a freedom to be released from fetters and to do whatever you want. It's a freedom that is important because it's a freedom to achieve a destiny. And that's the image that Jefferson is choosing. Israel, not just saying, hooray, we're free. It's Israel following God into the desert. And we know where they're going. They're going to Sinai, into the Promised Land. That's where they're heading. So each one here has a political concept. Each one is utilizing a biblical scene to send a political message. The two are very different messages, but they are complementary with one another and both profoundly Jewish.
One about a freedom, which is a condition of man. The other about freedom, which is a discipline for man.
That's right. And one builds on the other, of course.
One builds on the other. One which would speak to human ingenuity and human courage, the other the limits of human ingenuity and the need that we have for God's providence.
Well, it's an interesting way, because Jefferson's seal both depicts human courage, but it's also saying God has more in store for you than just being free and leaving you on your own. So Jefferson's seal, in part, actually captures both of those.
Next on Jewish Ideas and the American Founders, Talmud to Thomas Paine, Political Hebraism and the American Revolution.